And do you like cush crab better than square loaf, better than Force 12? I mean, the real choice here in many cases turns out to which one is better weatherproof, which one has better mechanical strength because it can survive a Hurricane Glory or a Hurricane Katrina, and which one satisfies my brand loyalty. So that's what it really comes down to, and occasionally which one gives me the biggest bang for the dollar. So a lot of variables involved. So please, you guys, stop sending us emails in which you say, should I buy brand A or brand B or brand C? If you're asking us for this particular application, should I go horizontal or vertical polarization, that's a more reasonable question. But of all the zillions of brands out there, you want us to select which brand of transmitting radio, which brand of antenna, which brand of transceiver, which brand of mobile rig, which brand of base station rig, which brand of matchbox, antenna tuner, antenna analyzer. These questions at first sound appropriate. They are inappropriate. Mel and I, for the most part, have no brand loyalty. I have a little bit of loyalty. Now, when it comes to commercial equipment, for a while I was in love with Hewlett-Packard, which became Agilent, particularly when it comes to computers. So I got some brand loyalty there. But that's just me and my subjectivity. Are they the best in the world? If you compare a modern-day Agilent network analyzer to a modern-day Rohde & Schwarz network analyzer, right now I favor Rohde & Schwarz. 5 years from now, my opinion may change. Day in, day out, I'm using the Rohde & Schwarz for the last 4 years, and I fell in love with the damn thing. I know all of its quirks, and I like what it can do. So that's the way I tune in, Teddy. The nice thing about a network analyzer, once you get familiar with it, and you go to the Smith chart display, boy, you're getting a megabyte of data swept in frequency on that screen. Once you figure out how to interpret it, wow, the equation of the world is there. Everything is there. And if you set it up correctly so that it's giving you a real-time display, you reach your finger into the middle of the antenna, and you watch the display zip immediately to the new display, and you find out, hey, I put my finger over here and it gets better. I put my finger over there and it gets worse. I pick up my little tuning tool of a long stick with a piece of copper on the end, and I tap the antenna on that end. Hey, it's getting better. I like it. It's becoming more broadband. It's becoming closer to a low standing wave antenna across the frequency range I want. And it's like a blind man walking up a hill. You can feel by the tilt of your feet which way is uphill. And I'm watching that screen, and I can tell when it's getting better, and I keep doing that screen, and then I go and try some other thing. With a real-time display, with tweaking, with a good network analyzer, I can test 30 antennas in a four-hour period. I can't model them that fast. And even when I did model it, to put all the raw data into the model to get an answer that's anything close to the truth requires a hell of a lot of time and a lot of grinding of the machine. And even after you do the model, because the data you put in is imperfect, you still have to go and build a working example of the darn thing. You have to do post-computer optimization, PCO, and you're going to build the real thing anyhow. You're way ahead of the game if you're a real ham radio tweaker type and you want to try a whole lot of things in a hurry. Get your hands on a real good network analyzer. I mean, yes, they're a bit expensive, but you take a club like Limark, which has got a lot of people and a lot of resources. You have smart people like Andy, the A2CDL. The club could decide to buy one good network analyzer and share it among the members. The meeting should start off with a half hour early where people meet in the back of the room and use the network analyzer and tweak their antennas. It's a possibility. And with a little bit of education, boy, you can try a lot of them in a hurry and get answers in real time, accurate to three decimal places. And I'm not kidding. That's how I'm designing a lot of antennas these days. It's a way that works for me. And I talk to my fellow antenna engineers, and I'm telling them what I'm doing, and I say, why are you doing it that way? The answer is that I get a lot of high-quality answers in a hurry. Well, they remember the days when they were using network analyzers, which were very slow in display, very cumbersome, and they weren't getting answers in real time. As I said, I can try 30 antenna experiments in a four-hour period. In some cases, I built three working antennas in that four-hour period. I can't model them that fast. You talk to a modern-day electronic engineer fresh out of a real good school like Georgia Institute of Technology, Stanford University, University of Virginia, MIT. And these guys are steeped in modeling techniques and high-frequency structure simulator, if they go deep enough, and some of these other Yagi Optimizer and whatever. And they think the whole world is modeling. I disagree. I didn't say that modeling doesn't work. To me, I have found a better, higher quality, faster approach with a better answer. That's an opinion. I think we've answered the question so far. If I missed anybody, before Mel and I and Paul do our next thing. And by the way, I'm going to first turn it over to see if there's any other questions on what you've heard so far. If not, I'm going to give you a quick rundown of my impression of Field Day 2007. I'm going to ask other people to give their opinion. So, first of all, are there any open questions right now? K2LAW in the tech net.
KC2MDP with a quick one, Dick.
Come on. Okay, MDP and Howie in that order. MDP, go ahead, Steve.
Okay, Dick, I just had a real quick question. Give me a basically short explanation for this one. Marine antennas, for fiberglass boats. Where do they get their ground from? I remember, when we had our boats, kids, the marine antenna, which was basically, it looked like, it almost looked like a 4-foot, real skinny fiberglass whip, and now that I think of it, it didn't look like there was any kind of, matching transformer or anything in this antenna. I'm curious, where do they get their ground from? Thank you.
Okay. My first question is, why the hell do you need a ground? Now, when it comes to base station antennas, the grounding we put on our equipment has three reasons for existence. Reason number one is human safety. You want the equipment grounded so if anything goes wrong, the hot side of a 110-volt line is not just... Hey, I just realized I didn't press in the darn little switch here. You guys have been listening to very mushy audio. Okay, there's a compressor switch on my Kenwood TS711 that I... didn't have it suppressed, so you were listening to a Bale of Cotton speech. The first reason you ground is for human safety. The second and third reason for grounding of lightning protection,
yeah,
and sometimes an improvement in the television interference. But the antennas that I'm designing these days are going into non-conducting packages, and classically, everybody builds an antenna which uses the printed circuit board as the ground plane. I'm talking about UHF and above antennas, 2 gig, 900 mega antennas. They use the ground plane of the printed circuit board as one terminal, as a counterpoise, and then build some kind of an antenna above it. And you're launching a god-awful amount of current into that ground plane, which lights up every other integrated circuit and every one of your computers and your displays and everything else, and creates all kinds of electromagnetic interference. All kinds of electromagnetic compatibility problems. Why in the world are we so resistant to using balanced antennas? You use a thoroughly balanced dipole-like antenna. I don't care if it's horizontally polarized, vertically polarized, or whatever. Use a balanced antenna. One half of the antenna is the radio. The other half of the antenna is the counterpoise. A balanced antenna, for radiation reason, for efficiency of transmitting reason, requires no ground. And if you don't like I'll admit that most balanced antennas tend toward full half-wavelength electronically. And if you don't like the physical amount of hardware of a half-wavelength electronically, there's all kinds of ways you can electronically shrink it down. Zigzag, inductive loading coils at the base, the middle, at the top, top-loading capacitors, and other techniques. There's a whole bunch of ways you can physically shrink down a balanced antenna. But once you decide that there's a lot of superiority in performance to a balanced antenna, and you stop launching all this RF current into the printed circuit board, you get all of these benefits, and you don't need a ground. I think you see where I'm going here, Steve. Back to you.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, maybe it was a poor choice of words on my part. Basically, yeah, that's what I mean. An unbalanced antenna, where would the counterpoise be? That's you.
Why are you using an unbalanced antenna?
Well, you know, like a dipole, you know, I know how you explain the dipole. You know, you have your one half, and then you basically have your other half. Don't you need some sort of, the way you explained it, basically something to push against? And a marine antenna, you just have that one vertical radial. Back to you.
Why isn't the one vertical radial a half-wave dipole? The half-wave dipole, each half pushes against the other. If you want it to be a pure antenna, and if you're not feeding it with twin lead, you're feeding with coax, you may want to use either a poor man's ballon or a real Unadilla ballon, if you know what I mean. But once you choose a full half-wave balanced antenna, you don't need a ground. You don't need a counterpoise. It is its own counterpoise. By definition, a balanced antenna is balanced. It needs no ground. Back to you, Bob. Steve.
HWW with a comment, Dick.
Stand by, Howie. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, I understand now. Very good. As long as it's a half-wave antenna, okay, I got you. Very good. Thank you, Dick.
Let me go one step further with this one, Steve. I buy myself a whiz-bang, multi-band, vertical antenna, quarter-wave type, ground plane antenna. I set it up in my backyard. The vertical radiator works like a charm. If and only if I lay down a lot of wires for the counterpoise. I'm trying to create that infinite sheet of metal for the other half of the antenna so that it reflects as a mirror for the upper half of the quarter wave real radiator. I'm trying to create a mirror image of it below ground. And I got to lay down a whole lot of copper wire for all of those radials, and the antenna is down at ground level. Lousy altitude. If I suddenly decide that, gee, I've got a tower, a tree, or whatever, that's got enough altitude that I can make a pure vertical half-wave dipole. Yeah, I'll admit that mechanically it's a little bit difficult to get the transmission line up to the center of that thing because it's above ground and it comes off at right angles. Mechanically, I'll admit that that's a little bit difficult. But if I make a full vertical half-wave dipole, not only will the signal be 6 dB stronger because it's more efficient because it's away from the ground, I've got one wire up above center where I'm feeding it, another wire down below center. That's a full half-wave dipole, quarter wave up, quarter wave down, and the feed line in the center. It doesn't need all those counterpoise wires. One wire up, one wire down, I've got 100% efficiency. Whereas on the ground, I don't get 100% efficiency until I lay down 60 wires. That's crazy. I get low altitude, poor performance, and a lot of work. Why the hell are we doing that? Make a pure vertical half-wave dipole, hang it at whatever altitude you've got, and if you haven't got enough altitude, find ways of mechanically shrinking it, but electronically making it half-wave, feed it in the center with a good balance, and you don't have to do all that, and you get a lot more performance. Talk to the guys who spend $400 for one of these multi-band ground plane antennas, they put it on the ground, and they compare it to a half-wave dipole, $3 worth of hardware, put up into the tree with a bow and arrow, and they get a hell of a lot more performance out of it. And they keep writing Mel and me saying, what in the world is going on here? What did that manufacturer do to me that's so bad? He didn't do anything so bad. You made a choice. With a little more knowledge, you're not going to make that choice, in my opinion. Let's start thinking about balanced antennas. They got a lot of bang for the dollar. What got us away from that? I'm getting hot in the collar over this one. Back to you, Steve.
Okay, Dick, very good. So in other words, okay, let me get this straight. A quarter wave antenna would be an unbalanced antenna. A half wave antenna is a balanced antenna. And as long as the antenna is balanced, you don't need that counterpoise. Is that correct, back to you?
Yay, verily. Give that man a cigar. You got the point. The other half of the antenna is the counterpoise. There's three, four different ways I can look at it. The antenna is thoroughly balanced, and by way of the ballon or a poor man's ballon, by a couple of coils of the transmission line of the coax near the antenna, I'm feeding it in a balanced manner, and it is a balanced antenna. It requires no ground. Or, conversely, I can say the upper half of it, the quarter wave whip on top, is the radiator. The quarter wave whip on the bottom is the resonant grounded structure. I could say that if you want to. It only takes one wire to do that. And now I have complete freedom to mount the whole darn thing above the ground if I've got the real estate to do it, if I've got the tree, the tower, or whatever. And I can do it in a sloper manner. And even though I call it a vertical halfway dipole, it doesn't have to be perfectly vertical. It can be a sloper at any angle that I got from my tower. It can become one of the guy wires if I'm smart enough to put egg insulators in the right spot of the guy wire. There's lots and lots of ways to go here. But it's time we go back to the basics. Isaac Hertz knew what he was doing when he made a balanced half-wave dipole. It was the later guys downrange who started making these quarter-wave ground plane things, and they said, gee, it's only got half the height, and I've got all this advantage. Sounds good. With the right kind of advertising, you can make it sound good. I think it's a pretty strong fit. I'm not in favor of ground plane antennas anymore, in many circumstances. So, we pay big bucks, we get something that looks nice, but it doesn't perform. If you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting what you've always got. And I'm hearing stories that I don't like what we're getting. I don't think we should keep doing it. Balanced antenna's got a lot going for it. I think if you see the philosophy that I'm developing on this, we should be doing it the other way around. Instead of starting off with a ground plane antenna and trying to justify a half-wave balanced antenna, if we had more objective thinking, we would start off with a half-wave balanced antenna and try to find out what in the world are people using in their brain to make them think that a unbalanced antenna is better. Just because it's got, think, half the length to it? When you include the real counterpoise that's required and all the grief that's required to do that and all the side effects you get of all the current that you're putting in the printed circuit boards in the case of small antennas on portable products, I don't think you want to go there. I know that this is not all going to sink in immediately. It's a philosophy I'm developing on antennas. I'm trying to convince you of what I think is the merit of this philosophy. I know that Mel and I are going to get a lot of emails on this because we're entering into a delicate area where people have got an emotional attachment to certain antenna types. And we're shooting arrows into those antenna types saying, are you sure you want to keep doing that? I'm not convinced it's the right way to go. Howie, I think you want to make some comments on this. WB2HWW, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Excuse me, disc number one, if you want those end connections, you get it from Tesco. Number two, both marine antennas, like the CB antennas, they're loaded half-wave. They're end-fed half-wave, so they don't need a ground plane. They're basically electrically a half-wave with the matching network at the bottom of the antenna at the base.
Well done. Well done. So, if I fall in love with the basic Heinrich Hertz half-wave dipole antenna, typically it is bow and arrow, wires and ropes in the trees, horizontal antenna, parallel to the ground, egg insulator in the center, and you hang the transmission line in the center. And so, when I make a vertical equivalent of that, naively, I try to make the vertical half-wave dipole, and at right angles bring in the transmission line. There's nothing magic about feeding a half-wave antenna in the center. With a little bit more smart and impedance matching, you can feed it at the bottom end. Mechanically, that's superior. Howie's on the right track here. And just because the radiator is a half-wavelength long doesn't mean it's not a half-wave vertical dipole. Just because it doesn't have an egg insulator in the center and it's got a short circuit in the center, common sense would lead you to believe, hey, that's not half-wave antenna anymore. It is. As far as the RF is concerned, the thing that's doing the radiating is a chunk of copper that is a half-wavelength long electronically. And whether you put a feed line and an egg insulator in the center, a transmission line and an egg insulator in the center, or you put a short circuit in the center and feed it from the bottom, is strictly up to you. It's your choice. The RF doesn't know the difference. The only slight difference is that when you feed it at the bottom, the impedance you're feeding is 2,000 ohms instead of 50. With a little bit of smarts, with a tapped loading coil, that's easy. Every one of those MagMount 5/8 wave whips that we've used on 2 meters and 220 and 440 and 70 centimeters all these years is a 5/8 wave antenna. It's just a little bit longer than half wave. You're feeding the bottom end of something that's essentially a half wavelength long, and when you go from half wave to 5/8 wave, the pattern difference you get is minor. But yes, it is the absolute peak as far as gain on the horizon is concerned. The difference between half wave and 5/8 is extremely small. But those 5/8 wave whips that we, mag mounts that we put on our car, you're feeding the bottom of electronically a half wave antenna. Works like a charm. Doesn't need a counterpoise. Because you're feeding the 3,000 ohm or whatever it is point. And when the impedance of where you're feeding is so high, the railing on your balcony of your apartment building is more than enough counterpoise. The coax cable that comes off, even if your railing is made out of PVC, is more than good enough counterpoise when you're feeding the 5,000 ohm point at one end. So life becomes a lot simpler if you start thinking halfway. Doesn't have to be fed in the center. Thank goodness Howie brought that to my attention. Lots of ways of feeding it. But the philosophy of half wave versus quarter wave, as I said, we've got to start thinking the other way around. Most of us have, up till now, think quarter wave and try to justify half wave. We've got to start thinking half wave and try to justify quarter wave. Why go there? Anybody got any further comments? K2LIW on the deck, man. Who was that? W2HLA is what it sounds like, but you're going to have to say it a little slower.
Even if it's W-O-T-C, Ian, with a late question.
Go ahead, Ian.
Good afternoon, Dick, and the deck. I'm just thinking feasibility, so I figured I'd get your opinion on this. I picked up an old Henry 2002 amplifier, and looking at the circuit diagram, comparing the 2002, which is the distributor version, and the 2004A, which is the 440 version of the amplifier, the only slight difference is the output section is a half wave on 432 as opposed to a quarter wave on 2/8. The input section, with the exception of a couple of coils, they're exactly the same in design. And thinking of converting the 2002 to a 432 amp amplifier, I've found, looking at a whole bunch of books, including the OR book, I've found output designs where the half-wave strip line matching capacitor, including capacitor. Problem I'm having is finding designs. Henry uses what I'll refer to as a T-match. Hopefully I'm stating it correctly. Use a T-match to match the input of the amplifier to the transceiver. And I haven't been able to find any designs that would give me the values. I've tried calling Henry, and because of the age of the amplifier, they've pretty much thrown away all their notes and so forth. I was wondering if you or anyone in the net might be able to help me in coming up with values, maybe some starting point that I can use to design the input to the network. I'd like to keep the existing, they have just one capacitor as a distributing unit for the input of the amplifier. And I'd like to keep that design without modifying it. I've seen other designs that have two capacitors and various coils to match the input section, but I'd like to keep the outside of the outside of the design. Wondering if you might give me some pointers. That's you. It's Ian is the name, and it's W-O-T-C.
Okay, Ian. I'm a strong advocate of half-wave resonators for UHF transmitter plate circuits. And anybody who builds a quarter-wave resonator, just like when they build a quarter-wave ground plane antenna, get a heap of trouble because the bypass capacitor for quarter-wave in many circumstances turns into a very troublesome component. The highest Q ground you can build the bypass capacitor for the quarter wave plate circuit resonator is another quarter wave of open circuit, called a sub. When you put it all together, yeah, it's a half wave plate circuit resonator. Way ahead of the game. Now, half wave
grid circuits and half-wave plate circuits in strip line is a reasonably popular amplifier called the parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432 megacycles. April and May 1972, QST magazine. Article won some awards. Probably 10 or 20% of all the guys who have ever done moonbound on 432 have used that amplifier. I probably could justify that there's 5,000 of them in operation right now. Maybe it's only 3,000. But some reasonably large number have been built. Most of them have worked. If the builder didn't make drastic modifications to the original design. And people have made some very intelligent modifications. The K1FO series of amplifiers is a commercial product that turned into. So if you look at April and May 1972 QST, and you can get those back issues from ARRL, that'll show you reasonably simple grid circuit for 4CX250B2, a pair of them, and a plate circuit, both of them half waves, for 4CX250B. So, and it's got a capacitive loading network on both the grid and the plate. I'm not quite sure of what physical real estate you've got inside of your Henry, but I think you could, on 70 centimeters, do it that way. So that'll give you some hints. Dillor's handbooks will give you some hints. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, had a series of articles about a half-wave strip-line plate resonator for $12.96 using 2C39 tubes. That'll give you some hints. Once you understand the concept of how they work, I think you'll be able to take either of those, modify it, any of those, in other words, modify it for your particular situation and have the minimum amount of grief. I don't know whether or not Steve K1FO has published any of the circuit diagrams of his amplifiers that he's selling. But if you get friendly with him, I think there's ways you can get that. But it's not that. The major variation he made was metering and safety, and he built in a bandpass filter to make sure it meets the FCC requirements for harmonic energy, which I don't think is your problem right now. So those will give you some hints. Back to you, Ian, if you need any further questions on that. After you study those particular articles, you're probably going to have a couple more questions, and I probably can answer them. You got it, Ian. W-O-2-Z, K-2-L-I-W.
Okay, great. It's going to be, I think you referred to the 4CX, not in Petro, but it uses the 3CX 800-87. In a grounded grid configuration triode. And most of the output strip lines, halfway strip lines that I've seen could easily fit into the RF deck of this amplifier. And there are some good input tuning circuits that I've seen too, which use a strip line built out of, a cathode strip line built out of, you know, like copper. And two capacitors that do the input tuning. But what I'd like to do is just keep the original Henry design that they had with the 432 amplifier that uses a T-match with just one tuning capacitor. And my only question or problem is coming up with the values for the coil that they use to create that match on the input circuit.
Yeah, the one tuning capacitor on the grid or cathode sounds like it's a simpler circuit. And you may get away with it. But you could say that one capacitor is only a tuning control. Any of the half-wave input circuits, whether it be cathode drive or grid drive, any of the half-wave input circuits that use two capacitors, one of them you could call the tuning control, one of them you could call the loading control. That gives you a lot more flexibility to give a good match between your driver and that final. So I don't recommend you skimp for any of the T-match type one single tuning capacitor. There's a lot more vulnerability where you're going to have to do a lot more tinkering, where
step by step, you're going to be creating that other capacitor. You might as well go for the other capacitor to begin with. That's my recommendation to him. And so, the article I'm telling you about, April and May, QST, 432, strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier. Yes, it uses 250Bs instead of 3CX 800, 85, or 87. There's a strong similarity between all those two, even though the 250B is a tetrode and the A7 is a triode. The plate circuits of both of those is almost identical. And when you're driving the cathode of a grounded grid versus the grid of a grounded cathode, tetrode versus the triode doesn't matter. The only difference of driving the cathode is you're driving a resistively lower impedance. You're driving the exact same amount of reactance. Hard to believe. So when you're driving the grid, I'm going to pick a number. Maybe you're driving 50 ohms. You're driving the cathode. Maybe you're driving 14 ohms. But that's just a rematching of the tuning and loading controls of the exact same input circuit two capacitor resonator. So once you go for the two capacitor type strip line, and by the way, that amplifier that I'm telling you about has a strip of copper, has a strip line for the input matching network, and a strip of copper clad, double-sided copper clad, for the plate circuit, which you can make it out of a solid chunk of copper if you want, but copper clad does the job very well. So to study those, it sounds like two articles. It's really one article in two consecutive issues. Half the article in each one, April and May 1972. It's an oldie, but it'll give you some hints. And after that, you'll ask the first question. Now, I'm going to flip over to the subject of Field Day. I visited the Lockfield group in Huntington, the Limar group in Wantagh, and then the Kings County group in Floyd Bennett Field in Brooklyn. And Mel and I and his buddies got into an interesting conversation where we started discussing our war stories about ham radio and cabbages and kings. And we had a whole bunch of subjects with reference to electronics, radio, and high voltage. And I guess we started around, Mel and I probably started at 8 o'clock at night. And I think we finished at 1:30 the next afternoon. So I guess that conversation between you, me, and your buddies at the Kings County Radio Club, I guess it lasted, see if I can figure out the numbers on this, 15 and a half hours. Boy, did we talk. Mel, where did you go for the field day? K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech net. And by the way, after Mel talks, I'm going to ask you guys, where did you go and what did you see? Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, good evening. All this is K2KEY. Yes, we had quite a time last night. Very interesting. Definitely, we had a very lively and interesting conversation. Covered a lot of territory. And, of course, Floyd Bennett is always a great place to have a field day. out in the field, but it is a nice place, very wide open. Usually, you know, the weather there is not overwhelmingly hot. Never have a situation where, you know, the heat is unbearable there because it gets a 90 degrees, which, of course, is right in our backyard. And then, of course, there are other attractions. At the 6, myself, we decided to take a walk around and went to the hangar and looked at quite a number of old airplanes, especially just a real hard look at a very big airplane that was an old cargo carrying airplane that was used in the Berlin airlift in 1947. That is the name of being restored. So I think that was quite interesting to look at. So we always have a nice time. Those who want to operate, of course, we have the operating, plenty of operating stations, and we like to walk around with some of the antiquities or the other things there that are of interest to Floyd Bennett. It's always been a place that whoever comes down to our field day has never been, you know, never left without saying that they had a wonderful time. So that's basically what we've done, and at the time when Dick was leaving, was finishing up field day, and then, of course, big job taking down all the antennas. So, KQRIW in the text net. This is KQRIW.
Yeah, I think most Saturdays and Sundays, and I'm not sure if Mel can correct me on this, at Floyd Bennett Field, the so-called hangar is open for inspection. I think it's run by the Floyd Bennett Recreation or Parks and Service. Parks and Recreation and Bird Sanctuary Service. If you've ever gone to what used to be Mitchell Field, I think it's Garden City, but it's the Cradle of Aviation Museum on Long Island, and you take two-thirds of those numbers of airplanes, and some of the really big ones, that's what you'll see at a couple of really big ones you'll see at Floyd Bennett Field. There's also a full Concorde there, not a mock-up, the real thing. You got a Concorde airplane and one end of the airport, and this great big hangar with another version of the Cradle of Aviation Museum, from my point of view. In the case of their hangar airplanes, you can go over and grab the propeller and push it a little bit, and kick the tires and so on. And run your hand over the rivet on the airplane, you're going to get feely touchy, and you see them restoring engines and whatever. It's a pretty big operation. It's kind of a fun place. So, I do recommend it. Mel's going to be telling us when I send it back to him what days, I think on most Saturdays and Sundays, it's open to the public. Is that true, Mel?
Yeah, most of the time, if you know, fellows show up there to work on the plane, usually they were, of course, busy with showing the people around, or they had some train set up there. They also, I think, dabble in a lot of rural odds and ends. Basically, you know, most of their work is in the shop with making parts and things, restoration of the aircraft that they have. But, you know, they also, I can say, the displays are very interesting. You know, those engines we looked at, oh boy, we looked at all kinds of engines that were, actually, like Dick said, hands-on. It actually touched parts of the engines that were sitting there. If you ever want to look inside the jet engine, or a helicopter engine, or some of the old radio engines. Very fascinating to look at engines, you know, from the past. In fact, even up to the, almost up to present day, turbo jet, there. And I always show that a lot of poking at a lot of airplanes and see what makes them tick. It was a real fun event. So I would assume, for this, especially the warm weather months, you'll find them there. Every weekend. You can always, if you're not, you won't be disappointed if you can take a ride down there, but it's always nice to walk around even. It's big, place is enormously big, and it's a place that if you take your kids especially with, they really do have a super time. So, this is KQKEY back to KQRIW, the tech center.
Yeah, that's a good point that Mel just made. If your son or daughter seems to have an interest in technology, aviation in particular, and even in a good HO train set, they'll enjoy those displays. If you've seen that PBS special that was on a few years ago, where a group of very enthusiastic guys tried to restore a B-29 that had landed in Greenland, and they tried restoring that airplane. Okay, you saw that the huge four-bladed prop pitch motor that adjusted the pitch on the blade, the great big radial engines, the four engines on a B-29. You've got the equivalent of that at Floyd Bennett Field, that exact engine prop and whatever. So you get a hands-on, first-hand experience of what those guys in Greenland were going through with that restoration effort, which was a real big one. Now, anyone else who went to field day, hopefully there were a lot of them, maybe some of these guys that did what Mel and I did, walked around the clock, worked around the clock at field day, and are snoozing right now. But if anybody else that went to field day and wants to tell us about it, what they saw, who they talked to, and what kind of antennas they set up, give me your call letters right now. KQLIW.
WJW.
KQQIW.
I got QIW and W2W or something like that first, and then we'll get QIW next, and I think it was the third one. O2W is it is. Give me those call letters a little bit slower, and go ahead and tell us what the field there was like for you, sir. Start over with your name.
Hi, this is Anthony. This is WW2W. I'm just going to add on to what you already said already. I guess make it quick.
Go ahead. Go right ahead, Tony.
Yes, first I'd like to say it was a pleasure meeting you, Dick, and being able to shoot things back and forth. You were there for quite a while. And also with K2KUY there, I did enjoy the conversation. We had a beam, we had dipoles up there, and, with everyone, the conditions were in and out, and some bands were really lousy. I just wanted to talk about the airport hangar there, between the restorations. They had cutaway presentation engines to look at the inside, and the big projects like that was the C-97 transfer plane. Some of these planes, the projects were so extensive. Inside the hangar, they had trailers just to handle the paperwork and ordering parts and coordinating with other stores. And I mean, these, like Dick was saying, if anyone has an interest in that type of thing, that's a grease monkey to me. I genuflect to those guys, because it's not a derogatory term to know what you're doing with that stuff with all those connectors and so forth from days gone by. It's unbelievable. And that plane that we were speaking about, actually some guy flew that in there. So that takes guts and a lot of know-how. So with regard to questions, let me drop it a second. Yeah, with regard to questions that came up, one of my questions, I don't know if you could speak about it now or some other time, I had for Dick was regarding black body radiators with regard to heat sinks. You know, why they work better, usually anodized black. Do they radiate heat, or is it convection, or both? Some of them designed for both, more or less, and why is less efficient if they're nice and shiny, that type of thing. And black body radiator, I look up, generally a perfect black body radiator has a radiating wavelength of infinity, which obviously is impossible, but that's standard, and that would be absolute zero, that type of thing. So let me give it back to Net Control. This is WW2W, and we had everybody operate the field day out there, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Very fine, Anthony. When it comes to heat sinks, and for solid-state devices like silicon transistors, most silicon transistors, you'd really like to keep the junction temperature of the transistor well below 150 degrees centigrade, more like 100 degrees centigrade if you can do that. As such, you're running the whole heat sink at rather low temperatures as far as infrared radiation is concerned. As such, the air moving past the fins of the radiator, the convection cooling, I am guessing is 90% of the cooling in most situations. And whether you've got shiny aluminum or black anodized aluminum, which is only the other 10%, yes, the black anodized is better, and as you get to hotter and hotter temperatures, it would really shine, pun intended. In other words, it would really start radiating more and more, but we don't go to those temperatures because our silicon transistors so far can't tolerate that. Or guess someday we'll be using silicon nitride or some of the much higher temperature transistors, and we'll be running heat sinks a lot hotter, and now the black body, black anodized type heat sinks will be much more efficient. So, yeah, go ahead and buy the black anodized one and get that last little bit of 10% efficiency, so to speak. But it's not the major. Making sure you got clear airflow in a fan is going to give you a lot more cooling than worrying about the black body now. But now, when it comes to black body radiators that give off heat, and that's the so-called T to the fourth effect. In other words, radiant heat, the watts per square foot, is a function of temperature in absolute degrees Kelvin to the fourth power. So until that temperature gets to be a big number, it's a very small number, and you multiply it to the fourth power, not much happens. It starts getting hot, boy, it happens in a hurry. So if you think that the radiant heat is important in your particular circumstance, then the word black body has got a very relative word to it. Your eye only sees the optical frequencies. Most of the real heat is given off in the far infrared. Your eye doesn't go there. And whether or not your heat sink is truly black for far infrared wavelengths is something you need other kinds of instrumentation to study. You can't tell with your eye. Now, if somebody tells you, I use black anodized by mil-spec procedure so-and-so, now you can find it. And there's ways you can look that up and find out what the radiant heat performance is going to be. But for the heat sinks that we've got on the microprocessors of our computers and the final transistors of our transmitters, convection, the air flowing past the fin, is 90-some-odd% of the radiation of the getting off of the heat, in my opinion. Now, I think the other person who signed in was KC2QIW. If so, that would be Bill. But if it's Bill, he changes call letters to W2ANG, so I may have the wrong guy. KT2QIW, question mark. Correct me on your call letters, give us your name, and proceed. What would feel like it feel like for you, sir, K2LIW?
This is KT2QIW. Your name is Joe.
Is that KC Kilo Charlie 2 Quebec India Whiskey? Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, it was my first, how you guys doing out there? Yeah, this weekend it was my first field day, and it was fun. They had like four or five radios set up, big barbecue over there in Yonkers. I brought my 4.5-year-old daughter with me. She had a great time. I was there like 10 hours. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Yeah, KC2QYW for ID.
There's a correction. Quebec Yankee whiskey, not Quebec Indian whiskey, is what I thought I heard. Very fine, then. Bill. And was there another person who wanted to tell us their field day experience? Give us your call letters right now.
KB1OQD.
It's OQD. Start off your name and go right ahead.
Yeah, they just Bob over here in Greenwich. Now, we don't have a field day experience. We didn't get to go there, but we heard a gentleman talking about the radiators and heat sinks. I have a ST7800 Yaesu mobile here, and it gets warmed up when it's running 50 watts there. You know, the fan kicks on constantly. So what I did is I took the mobile, flipped it upside down on its bracket, so as usual, it rises. Now, I have a cooling fan, a muffin fan from a computer, runs on 12 volts there, that I can hook up to the power pack. Is this better to run the fan across the heat sink, or is it better to turn around and pull the heat from the heat sink on the radio?
I think you're asking, is it better to push the air or pull the air? Is what I think you're asking. And the answer is whichever creates the greatest amount of air in cubic feet per minute flowing through the fin. I think pushing most of the time will push a little bit more air through the fin. Whereas when you're sucking, some of the air goes past the fins and some of the air will be coming in by sneak paths to the fan. That's my first guess on that one. There's all kinds of ways you can put Kleenex, for instance. If you take Kleenex and separate individual layers, you've got some very thin pieces of paper. And you put little pieces of it as tufts of paper held down with tiny little pieces of scotch tape, and you put them in various places along the fins of the heat sink and turn on the fan. By the way they wave in the breeze, you'll find out very rapidly how the air is flowing. That's exactly what the sailplane pilots do. They've got this tuft of, what would you call it now? Fluffy nylon material that's taped down or screw down to the front of the nose of the sailplane. And by the way that waves in the breeze, you find out right away whether or not the airplane is flipping sideways or flying correctly. So to visualize the way air flows over a wing, over a fuselage or whatever of an airplane, little fluffy tufts of bendable materials on the surface gives you that answer real well. So you can do that with your heat sink and then study the various places you put the fan, which one gives you the greatest amount of flow of air through the fins itself. What if it made some sense, Bob? Go ahead.
Yeah, it does. I noticed when I laid the fan on top of the unit, I was getting a little, I guess, hum from the fan running there back through the unit there. So I kind of took some chopsticks there, stuck them into where the screw hose goes, where the mounting is, and just kind of lifted it up off the unit there a little bit more so it wasn't directly pushing it. It alleviated that hum there, but I was just curious, blowing it across it or actually, you know, sucking the heat up off it there, unit there. I guess blowing on it would conduct more air. See, what I didn't want to do, I didn't want to disrupt the fan that's on there already, its air flow is, and it's, you know, made for it. So that's what I wanted to find out.
There's another way you can do this one, Bob, and that is by way of a thermocouple, thermometer, or whatever. You can put that thermocouple with a little piece of clay, putty, or whatever, or the thermometer, attach it to any convenient place on the heatsink, key the transmitter in the FM mode without speaking into the microphone into your favorite antenna for, we'll say, a 3-minute period of time, and measure the temperature rise. Then move the fan to the other place and measure the temperature rise again. And go for the fan placement that gives you the least amount of temperature rise. So you can measure the bottom line by measuring temperature. That's an approach. Do worry about the fact that a brushless fan does put out a pretty strong magnetic field. That magnetic field near the front end of the transmitter circuitry, the audio circuitry, could couple in a phony signal. The fan itself, if it's not perfectly balanced, has some mechanical vibration, which can be coupled into the cabinet and give you some funny sounds coming out of your transmitter. And by the right kind of shock mounting with rubber washers and things like this, there's various ways you can take the vibration of the fan away from the rig and get rid of that problem. And talking to your buddies over the air and asking which one sounds better will give you some other clues, or listening with another rig. The nice thing about an FM rig is that in the shack with you or in the automobile with you, you could have a handy talkie with earphones on the handy talkie, and you don't run into an overload problem. In other words, most handy talkie receivers, even though the FM transmitter is 1 foot away, what really goes out over the air audio-wise of FM, you can pick it up on the handy talkie or any other rig and listen to it. You try doing that with AM or sideband, amplitude overload will give you a distorted signal, and you don't really hear what's going out. But with FM, you will. So there's various ways you can test whether or not you're putting out a strenuous sound. So good luck with that project, Bob. Let's see if Paul has got some new things to tell us about space. The space shuttle did land. I think they landed on Friday. I think they landed at Edwards Air Force Base. I was at Edwards on the main runway, let me think now, March of 1989, and I saw that space shuttle land on that runway aimed toward me, but I was at the far end of the runway. Excited to watch it land. So I think they landed at Edwards. I have watched them with very fancy machinery pick up the space shuttle off the runway, so to speak, and mount it on top of that 747 properly equipped aircraft that flies it back to Kennedy Space Center and to the vertical assembly building so they get it ready for the next flight. So because of weather conditions, I think they weren't able to land in Florida where they really wanted to land. So they got now fly it across the country. And it costs a little bit of extra money and time to do that. So I think that's what happened. Paul's going to bring us up to speed on that one. WS2M, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, they're up there. $1.5 million to bring it back from California. So, that's the way it goes. Oh, by the way, very good on field day. Well, I don't have a field day story. I operated one Delta, so there you go. I still send the papers in for it. By the way, you had a boy your point. You could go to field day, or you could do it at home. So I treat it more like a contest. So that's my field day story. I used to do one Bravo quite a bit, set the tent up in the backyard and run off a bunch of batteries, but lately that's become a little too much work with those car batteries. Space Shuttle came back Friday. It was supposed to come back Thursday, and they had weather problems in Florida. So they got waved off until Friday, and then they got waved off again. They were going to try for Florida, but no good with the winds and all. So they're out $1.5 million. They got a bunch of people from here to Florida, set the whole thing up on top of the 747 and bring it back. So it's a bit costly. And it also delays a little time for the shuttle to be refurbished for its next flight. But it went well. The piece of cloth didn't tear off. They temporarily repaired up there. There was some thermal cloth back by the Ohms engine, the orbital maneuvering engine. Essentially, the top of the engine had a piece of thermal cloth that was peeled back a couple of inches, and they did the spacewalk to repair that. That held together. And they got the S3 and S4 truss sections working. That's another one of those truss sections with a gigantic joint in there to rotate the solar arrays every hour and a half to match the sun, keep the constant with the sun with the solar arrays. They got that thing working and operable. It looks good when they pulled away from the station. I like that bisymmetric look. I didn't like it offset with the one set of solar arrays sticking out on the port side. And now you got the port and the starboard, and eventually you have another set go up to the starboard, and that will be attached to along that truss, so it's next to the existing solar arrays that are up there. So that'll increase the solar arrays on that side, that whole section will be doubled on that side, and then eventually they'll take the existing solar array that's sitting on top of the Destiny lab that they used all these years. That's all furled up now. They'll disconnect that and put that on the port side. So once that's all done, those two maneuvers are done, you'll increase the station size, what you can see of it, by twice the amount. And then they'll be able to bring up some of the labs that are ready to go. The European Space Agency has a Columbia lab that's supposed to go up. It's as big as the American Destiny lab. And that'll be attached to the Japanese lab that's ready for flight. That'll be able to go up. So you'll have plenty of power to support all these things. WS2N. And that's pretty much it.